ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Canto 3, Chapter 3, Text 17. We heard Uddhava's remembrance of Krishna about the withdrawing of the Yadu dynasty and his reasons for doing that and how he felt about it. He ended up with text 16, Krishna, thus thinking, established Maharaj Yudhisthira in the position of supreme control of the world. So what actually happened, he was contemplating. After the battle was over, he contemplated what has to happen, and he then installed Maharaj Yudhisthira. Now it goes back to protecting Maharaj Prikshit within the womb of Uttara. Towards the end of the battle. The embryo of Puru's descendant, begotten by the great hero Abhimanyu, in the womb of Uttara, his wife, was burnt by the weapon of the son of Drona, but later he was again protected by the Lord. Report by Srila Prabhupada. This is something they're not accustomed to hearing. The body that Maharaj Prikshit had was burnt. Krishna then supplied him another one. That's what we're going to hear. The embryonic body of Maharaj Prikshit, which was in formation after Uttara's pregnancy by Abhimanyu, the great hero, was burned by the Brahmastra of Ashvatthama, but a second body was given by the Lord within the womb, and thus the descendant of Puru was saved. This incident is the direct proof that the body and the living entity, the spiritual spark, are different. When the living entity takes shelter in the womb of a woman through the injection of the semen of a man, there is an emulsification of the man's and the woman's discharges, and thus a body is formed the size of a pea, gradually developing into a complete body. But if the developing embryo is destroyed in some way or another, the living entity has to take shelter of another body or in the womb of another woman. The particular living entity who was selected to be the descendant of Maharaj Puru, or the Pandavas, was not an ordinary living entity, and by the superior will of the Lord, he was destined to be the successor to Maharaj Yudhisthira. Therefore, when Ashvatthama destroyed the embryo of Maharaj Prikshit, the Lord, by his internal potency, entered into the womb of Uttara by his plenary portion, just to give audience to the would-be Maharaj Prikshit, who was in great danger. By his appearance within the womb, the Lord encouraged the child and gave him complete protection in a new body by his omnipotency. By his power of omnipresence, he was present both inside and outside of Uttara and other members of the Pandava family. Well, we don't normally hear this description. And even when the same in detail was discussed in Canto 1, no mention was made. So that the body of Maharaj Pariksit was burned and a second body was given by the Supreme Lord. Repeating, but it's not commonly part of the description. So we don't need to make a big deal about it. Maybe with a particular emphasis each time we describe that situation. It's a detail. It's a nice detail. The detail that Prabhupada concludes from it is the body and the soul are different. If the body was destroyed, that means if that was the self, then that entity is gone. But because the body is not the self, when the body was destroyed, the self wasn't destroyed, and a different body was given. And this is the Lord's omnipotency, that he can bring things into being just by his willing them to come into being. Who can do that? You will something into being and it just comes into being. We can't do that. But because we can't do that doesn't mean we can't do that. And his omnipresence is also identified. The omnipresence in the sense that Krishna was outside or external to Uttara, because Uttara had come running, "Krishna, Krishna, please protect me, or please protect the child within my womb." So Krishna was outside, but then Krishna expanded by his plenary portion. He entered into the womb of Uttara by his plenary portion with a twofold purpose. One, protect the child. The second was to give his darshan to the child. Specifically, that's mentioned in the first canto. Of just appropriate size, thumb size, so this little entity within the womb of Uttara could see. Just appropriate for his darshan. Omnipresence doesn't mean that Krishna was over there and he like projected a form of himself over here. But he's always everywhere present. He's always everywhere present in a number of ways. He's everywhere present by his energies, which are everywhere. Prabhupada described there's God, and there's God's energies, and there's not a third thing. Or another way is, there's no void in the creation of God. There's not like there's God, and then there's energies, and then there's something else. Like nothingness, or void, or something where he's absent. No such thing. So, he's all-pervasive by his energies. He's all-pervasive by his Brahman feature. He's all-pervasive by his Paramatma feature. So, since he's all-pervasive, where did that form which appeared before Maharaj Parikshit appear from? Krishna expanded, that's option A. Krishna's over here, over there, and he appeared over here. He expanded himself. Or option B, from the spiritual world, Krishna manifested this form in front of Maharaj Parikshit. Or C, he's present everywhere as Paramatma, and he manifested that feature of Paramatma in a suitable size. And then where did he go afterwards? Same thing. He's all-pervasive. He's already all-pervasive. He did it was effortless. He just made himself visible. Same each of the appearances of the Lord. There's some perhaps Leela involved. Dhruva Maharaj was seeing that form of the Lord within his heart in trance. Meanwhile, the demigods were suffocating, went to Shirodakshai Vishnu, the abode of the Lord, and Svetadvip. Oh, we can't breathe. Don't worry. There's a small boy in the forest, and I'll appear very soon and take care of the whole thing. So, then apparently he appeared from Svetadvip. And then suddenly that form disappeared from Dhruva's heart, and then he was standing before him. So did he appear from his heart? Did he appear from Svetadvip? Is he all-pervasive? And he just manifested one form and withdrew the vision of this other form. And then when he disappeared, where did he go to? He's all-pervasive. And he's omnipotent. And everything acts according to his will, so he can appear and disappear. He may have an entrance leela and a departure leela, coming on the back of Garuda, apparently from Svetadvip. But how long does it take to get from Svetadvip to the Earth planet? No time at all. Because we're restricted by time and space, and we're restricted by limited potency, to try to calculate what the Lord can do based upon our limitations is a fool's venture, or Dr. Frog. But specifically, Prabhupada is indicating he's demonstrating or exhibiting his omnipresence in his manifesting before Maharaj Parikshit. And the protection of his devotee, another of Krishna's qualities, he's the protector of his devotee. He, not exactly arranged, but he sanctioned the difficulty, because Ashvatthama, like any other being, can't do anything without the sanction of the Lord. So, not that the personality of God had willed, okay, Ashvatthama, here's something I want you to do, why don't you go release a Brahmastra weapon against Maharaj Parikshit, because I'm going to appear over there and check it. But the sanction of the will of a living entity is in the Lord's hand. And in the case of his devotee, Krishna personally intervenes. He's not interfering with that living entity's free will. At the same time, he has his own unlimited free will, and he exercises it. He's not constrained. Oh, he can't do that. Oh, yes, he can. Without interfering with Ashwatthama's free will, he can. Because the outcome is in the Lord's hand. Prabhupada, a point that Prabhupada is making in the purport is that this particular living entity was to become, because of his great qualifications, very, very special, you know, pre-qualification, he was to become the heir to the throne of Maharaj Yudhisthira. Very much like Krishna showing showing Arjuna the universal form, and within that universal form, the outcome of the battle was already established. Krishna wanted Yudhisthira to become the emperor. And when Krishna wills something, it's unstoppable. Still, there's freedom of the living entity. And they're not contradictions. Arjuna could choose to fight or not. It was his option. Nonetheless, the outcome of the battle was already decided. That means someone else would be empowered, or whatever the arrangement Krishna wanted to make, but the outcome is not dependent upon our free will, and our free will doesn't determine an outcome. Krishna's will is operative. Krishna's not a machine or a non-entity or an automaton or something. He's a person whose will is indomitable. And within that context, we have our minute free will. We can choose to serve Krishna or not, or choose to serve him unfavorably, or choose to serve him favorably. Minute free will is operative, while the Lord's supreme free will is fully operative. So it was his will that this living entity become the successor of the throne of Yudhisthira. And so the Lord ensured that it happened, along with showing special mercy to Maharaj Parikshit that he had his darshan. How dear was Maharaj Parikshit? In the Jewish faith, there's I don't know the detail of it, but there's some idea of the chosen people. And somehow, as chosen people, they had their trials and tribulations, historically. I mean, like, and that's to be accepted. So what to speak of Maharaj Parikshit? A chosen being before he was born, he was special. His role was determined, his protection was determined, his darshan of the Lord was arranged. How special was Maharaj Parikshit? So Uddhava's thoughts are going to him, and the Lord's intervention, with the Lord's exchange with him. I'm going to end there. See if we have Any questions or comments?
Would it be safe to say that, like, Krishna's will generally is like kind of broad to allow the living in this minute field to operate, to change certain details within that broad will, or
it's not exactly as you said it. It's intrinsic to the soul. He doesn't allow free will. They're his part and parcel. He doesn't like allow himself to have free will. He has unlimited free will. Living entities have his parts and parcels. Intrinsically, they have free will. Mm-hmm. Minute, but they have it. But it's intrinsic. It's of their nature. Not like gifts, the connotation is you can take it away. Or rearrange how much free will they have. So it's a language thing. You know, he doesn't give it, they have it. It's of their nature. Something that even the Lord doesn't take away, nor does he give.
I was particularly thinking, like, from Krishna's standpoint, he wants all the living entities to come back to him. But there is a time delay between his will, and there are some instrumental roles being played by different parts and parcels, and the details are kind of going to and fro between, like, the struggle and trying to see who can turn back and who cannot. And I mean, there are, like, pure devotees are working so hard in trying to align their interest with the interest of Krishna, but, like, Krishna overall wants, like, all the living entities to come back to him, but in the middle, like, there are so many detailed diversions which are happening. So I was just thinking whether
waiting for the punchline.
So, because Krishna wants...
Don't say it again. What's the punchline?
So, the punchline is that Krishna is deciding on, like, the broad outcome,
no,
and the living entities are...
No. Because, go to the furthest extreme, and must all living entities eventually return to Krishna because Krishna wills it?
Uh-huh.
The answer is no. They may stay forever. It's a nice theory, but no. Anyone else? Go ahead.
Guru Maharaj, this is a question from yesterday's class. On the topic of burden. So something that I've observed in a scene, especially with close relatives, like, there is this common thought that I'm a burden to others, like, especially when there is some disease or health issues or...
Your wife was speaking one thing yesterday too.
Yeah. So, like, I saw that in my own mother's case, like, when something struck, she just kind of withdrew, thinking that I'm just a burden. So I'm just wondering, how do we help such people? I know it's a very broad question, but and there's those who are practicing Krishna consciousness, and among relatives there are others who aren't, so I was wondering if you could kind of...
Well, I can say two things. One is become Krishna conscious. That's the best way of helping others. And the second is, when you become Krishna conscious, you have a better insight into how to help others. Because if you were supplied the second part before the first part, you wouldn't necessarily know what to do with it or be able to carry it out. So situations of people's lives change by your becoming Krishna conscious, particularly those that are dear to you or those that are related to you. Amoga and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya are examples, just by being related and thus receiving the well-wishing of an elevated Vaishnava. Situations in people's lives can change. Praying. That also requires, you know, how effective is that going to be? It depends on our Krishna consciousness. So the solution is to be Krishna conscious. And Krishna will give some inspiration accordingly.
Guru Maharaj, regarding this question of free will of living entity, I was connecting it with what you shared yesterday, that everything should be done for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. I realized that so many or most of the times when I try to please by descending mercy, there is a desire to please Guru and Krishna, but while executing my services and the consciousness that I carry, I do sense that there are so many things that are displeasing. There is faith that the spiritual master and Krishna loves me very much, but then how to settle with that feeling that I may have displeased, or
that I may have displeased? Well, this is one of these classic territories where recognition and regret have their place, but dwelling on it doesn't. If there's recognition and regret, then you move positively. It's impetus to move positively, not impetus to dwell and continue to lament. Move into the rectification, don't just stay in the regret. Let it be impetus to move into rectification. Your specific question was how to deal with that feeling. And that's, I'm giving you a specific answer. Let that feeling be impetus to move into rectification. And then the next question is, the yabhat is, yabhat, you know, I find that I just like, you know, I do it again and again. It's like, it doesn't go away so easily. So that kind of reinforces that feeling. Right, you know. How to deal with that feeling. So it's the same, you know, it's acknowledgement of my limitation. This is this with the youth group in Chicago. Self-honesty says, this is my situation. And then self-improvement is not, okay, now I'm going to do it. It's, I'm going to make some effort, recognizing my limitation with dependence upon descending mercy. No. If one of those principles is missing, then you're still stuck. You make effort, but it's not your own effort, because if it's your own effort, it's insufficient. You're stuck. Because our own effort is insufficient. However competent or lacking in competency we may have, it's, you know, this end of the spectrum, that end of the spectrum, it's insufficient. Because it's not really the principle of overcoming our deficiencies. It's receiving mercy. And then you're connected. And zoom, zoom, off you go.
Guru Maharaj is always like so much to improve on, like...
Okay, take one thing at a time. Don't get overwhelmed, take one thing at a time. And you go, now go back to the premise that you started with. I know that I'm accepted and loved by Guru and Krishna. So just keep going back to that. That's your battery charge. Yeah?
One of the messages we did was... outcome doesn't depend on the free will.
Outcome doesn't depend on?
On the free will of the living entity.
On the free will.
But how it works?
Well, it's not the sole determining factor. Free will needs to be there. Exercise of free will needs to be there. Endeavor needs to be there. One of the five factors of action is endeavor. So endeavor alone isn't going to determine an outcome. But endeavor must be there. I'm listening.
Specifically, I was wondering, in case of when we make a wrong choice, and then we get reactions that outcome is dependent on, because I made a wrong choice, and then getting my reaction, say,
okay.
Chanting.
Okay,
well.
Okay.
So, it's
so what specifically about that?
So, in that case, it appears that the outcome was dependent on the wrong choice. Like, I got reaction because I made the wrong choice.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So.
There's five factors action. That's one of them. Ultimately, it's super soul. He's not a zero. Or he's not... He can make an exception if he wants to. And there's nothing stopping him from doing that.
When some reaction comes, like sometimes immediate, is it okay to accept that I made this?
Yes. That the classic or the standard is Lord Brahma and his prayer. I accept the reaction that's coming to me, but I will not budge an inch from the position of serving the lotus feet of the Lord. Mm. Classic.
But not in the mood, because I tend to think that. Well, Krishna is punishing. Krishna is not like that, but, you know,
taking
shelter.
Yeah, I think a better way to think is I take responsibility.
Mm.
I accept responsibility for my choices.
Mm.
And it was, whatever the circumstance, a bad choice. I take responsibility for that.
Mm.
I'm not trying to dodge the responsibility or the outcome, the consequence, or blame others, or, you know, I'm not going to waste energy doing any of those things. There's an outcome.
Mm.
I accept responsibility for it. Not like I created it. I accept responsibility for it. it's part of nature's arrangement or God's arrangement for one who makes such foolish choices as I just made, there's an outcome. Okay, thank you very much. You're very
proud. Yeah. Little thoughts on that.